Great. So I'm going to take some of the themes that Eric developed this morning and try to offer you our view of the problem in the context of the system that we are trying to study, which is this type. This is not a jellyfish or some kind of weird marine organism. It's actually the brain of a fly and or the optic system of a fly.
Well, up to some.
Yes.
Really?
Yeah.
Can you just tell us what?
I will tell you. I will tell you more.
It looks like a jellyfish.
Yeah. So
I
think
you just show us what the
we are into. I'm going to go back to the same image. So I think over the last few decades, we have learned quite a lot about how cell can acquire identity. And in particular, we have focused a lot of attention. I think we know very well how binary decisions are being made. For example, how a cell, neuroblast could delaminate, and at least through asymmetric distribution of some factor along some axis of the cell, you can have the cell A and the cell B to acquire different fate. So this is actually fairly well understood molecularly. What is a bit less well understood is that actually when you have to make several choices out of one single cell, and how, for example, this cell can acquire choice A, B, C, and D. So actually there are several examples which are fairly well known understood. And for example, in C. elegans, everything is basically simple when you have repetition of this binary decision which is being made. We call this a lineage, cell lineage-based type of development where the different fates at the end are just a consequence of basically binary choice made at each cell division. This is very simple. I don't think it's something which is too widespread in a sense that I don't think there are too many examples like this in the context of the organism we work with on flies or higher organisms. Now, there are other systems we also talked about yesterday when actually cells divide and then you have a bunch of cells which appear to be all equivalent and then there is a morphogenetic gradient, and this morphogenetic gradient basically patterns those cells. When you have a high level, you have A, and when you have a low level, you have H. And there are many examples we heard yesterday about the bicoid system, how bicoid can set up the positional value of different genes along the anterior posterior axis. Or you can also see the hedgehog in the context of the vertebrate nerve cord. Our hedgehog can pattern the DV axis of the nerve cord. And we heard also a lot yesterday about the image.
I'd argue that this is very deceptive, because it implies that the morphogen is actually providing. The small gradients of the morphogen are actually providing those different identities, and I don't think anybody really knows that for sure, since there's pre-pattern. And so just to say that the different amounts between C and D are providing a different identity, I don't think that's established for them.
I think what is established is that, the way we define a morphogenetic gradient is when actually a single factor makes more than a binary decision. That means you become a morphogen, you get a higher status when you have more than two positions, when you get three positions. And in general, it's off, on, and something in between.
Yeah.
And of course, this is basically a gross over-interpretation, what a morphogenetic gradient could do. But indeed, I agree with you that nobody has been able to show more than three, maybe. I think in the context of the flying wheel, we have more than three positional values, which have been defined. But
by one factor, though, I would argue.
By bicoid?
Yeah, I would argue not.
But anyway, this is just an example of the type of thing that can be done. And you're going to see that, of course, there is not a single answer in biology. So, and then we have some other process which are very interesting, and I think I refer you to the work from Jeff Axelrod and other people, which are basically systems which are self-organized. And for example, I'm talking about planar polarity. Tissue planar polarity is how cells acquire their hair, which all point in the same direction. And what seemed to happen, and actually it's quite simple, was the blue stuff like the red stuff on the other side of the membrane, and basically they are going to attract each other, deplete this side from the blue stuff, and going basically to have some form of propagation which is self-sustained. And what the gradient in this case is just providing some general orientation, that everything is self-organized, it just provides some cues, some header, you should all go into this direction. But it can just work by itself, it just provides the vector along to which it should do. And then you have some extreme other side where actually specification occurs where all the cells are the same, and then each cell is going to make a stochastic choice. And I'm going to give an example of what's happened in the olfactory system. In the olfactory system, in the nose epithelium, you have 1,000 different types of cells that can be born. So you have a nose epithelium, you have many cells, and each cell makes a choice. It makes a choice out of 1,000 choices, and once you stick to this choice, it excludes all of the other 999 choices. This is something which is not understood at all molecularly, and presumably it might involve the end product of differentiation of the gene, which are the receptor, for example, in this case, the olfactory receptor. And I may come back to that briefly. And so here is a very extreme thing. So basically, a stochastic choice, cell decide whether, oh, I'm going to choose this one, then exclude all of the other. Okay? And then, of course, we have the type of system that we have heard this morning and yesterday, where things are way too complicated to understand what happened. And when you have actually some cell interaction between some decisions which are being made between cells, and basically it's hard to draw some general rule about how this works. But that is the system that we're going to try to understand today. And for instance, we can see what happened in the context of the vertebrate eye. When actually from a population of cells, you have seven types of neurons which are being formed through this type of complex cell interaction and give rise to the complete vertebrate retina. But of course, we are not interested in the vertebrate retina because it's way too complex. And as people said yesterday, we need to choose a system which is very simple. And we chose a system which is very simple, the fly eye. The fly eye is what we call fly eye. But this is not a fly eye. It's a compound eye. What we need to be interested in actually is one of these facets, which is a very simplified eye, which is actually made of 8 cells. And this 8 cells actually can be then subdivided into subgroups. We have one set of 6 cells, 6 outer photoreceptor cells, which are fairly big cells, okay, and they all are disposed as a trapezoid shape, and they're called outer photoreceptor cells. They have a property actually of, they're actually basically the rods of the fly eye. What their purpose in life is to absorb as much light as possible to be able to provide a black and white vision to the fly. So what happens, light gets in, goes through this long fiber optic, and get out here, and the process is being absorbed by a very broad spectrum rhodopsin, the pigment that absorbs light, okay? So they have a very big surface and they have a long lens to be able to absorb as many photons as possible. In the middle here, there is 2 photoreceptors. You only see one, because actually there are 2 photoreceptors which are one on top of each other, the purple one and the green one, and those are basically the cones of the fly in the sense they are involved in absorbing different wavelengths of light and being able to discriminate among colors. And actually, they're in a perfect configuration for doing that because, as you understand, in order to be able to discriminate color, you need to be able to compare the input of photoreceptor that absorb in different wavelengths. And the best configuration for doing that is to have them in the same fiber optic, where basically the photon comes through the purple and then through the green. Those absorb in different wavelengths, and by comparing the input of those, you can basically achieve color discrimination. From a schematic point of view, there is another thing that we can discriminate among those two systems is actually the outer photoreceptors, those big ones, the rods of the fly, project into the brain where they need to do image formation. And they project to one specific part of the brain called the lamina. While the other inner photoreceptor cells, R7RA, which again absorb in different wavelengths, are going to project through the lamina, but don't stop there and keep going into a specific center where actually color processing is going to occur, again by comparing the input of those two cells. You can see the dichotomy between those two different types of systems. So now, let's go back to those photoreceptors and the type. Okay, so actually this is, to go back to your image, this is the picture of a fly eye dissected, and what you have here, the omatidia, so the 800 omatidia individual eye, and that is the 8 photoreceptors that you have here. There's an axon bundle of 8 axons. 6 of those axons are going to stop here into the lamina. That's a black and white system, and 2 of them are going to continue down into the medullary part of the optic lobe, where they do this projection here, where color processing is going to occur. So again, going back to those photoreceptors here, those photoreceptors express different types of rhodopsin. In UV rhodopsin, called rhodopsin 3 or rhodopsin 4, or another type of rhodopsin in R8 underlying cell, a blue or green rhodopsin, rhodopsin 5 or rhodopsin 6. Now, there is something you have to realize, that in sensory system, you cannot afford to have 2 rhodopsin in the same cell, or 2 type of receptor in the same cell, because the cell will be confused. So you can only have rhodopsin 3 or rhodopsin 4, rhodopsin 5 or rhodopsin 6. Okay, this is very important, which means that in fact, you have 4 types of cell. You have R7 express rhodopsin 3 or rhodopsin 4, R8 express rhodopsin 5 or rhodopsin 6. Now, how is this achieved, and how is the distribution of these different categories of cells? This is staining in the R8 layer for the 2 rhodopsin, rhodopsin 4, 5, and rhodopsin 6, the 2 R8 rhodopsin, the blue or green. And there is something interesting that you see here. It's basically that we have exclusion. I mentioned this earlier with the olfactory system. And the exclusion seems to be total. But there is also something bizarre, that it seems that there is no pattern to exist. So as here, there is something which is quite important, which always dismissed in biology, is that the stochastic nature of the expression of those things, which I think we have to take into consideration. So stochastic expression of those genes, and then mutual exclusion. Again, very similar to what I mentioned earlier with the olfactory system. Actually, on the overlying R7 cell, you have the same type of expression where both R7 belong to two types, or three types, in fact. Those express rhodopsin 3, those express rhodopsin 4, and again, stochastic distribution and exclusion. Except here in this dorsal rim area, it's a special part of the eye which has a different function, I will go back to that later, where everybody expresses rhodopsin 3. So you have here stochastic distribution and some kind of more biased expression, but in every case you have exclusion, again, to avoid sensory confusion. So actually, to go back to this stochastic expression, I might want to go back to the function of the visual system. The visual system, the most important function of the visual system is to perceive the world at a distance. And as such, what the visual system does, it projects the image very precisely on the retina. But then you need to interpret this image. And as a consequence of that, you need to project this image from the retina onto the brain through what we call a retinotopic map. What I mean by that, actually, there is a one-to-one correspondence between the projection onto the optic lobe from the retina. And again, because what the fly needs to do, what the visual system needs to do, is to precisely know where each point in space is. And actually, I call this a spatial map, because it's really the spatial representation which is the most important. Now, other sensory systems, such as the olfactory system, they don't really care about where the odor comes from. What they care about is the quality of the odor. And the consequence, the system is designed totally differently, in the sense that now what you have at the level of the olfactory epithelium, a random expression of those olfactory receptors. And again, it doesn't matter where they are, as long as you have a big diversity. But then you need to sort out this diversity. And that is the way the olfactory bulb is organized, that all those olfactory receptors that express a given receptor molecule are going to all project to the same place onto the olfactory bulb. Which means here, things are not sorted spatially, they are sorted by quality. So I call this a qualitative map. Now, you remember what I just described to you just a few slides above. This expression is exactly the same. What you have here, you don't care so much about the spatial distribution. You only care about the quality of the input, because obviously those are going to detect different types of input. And indeed, what you can imagine that this kind of representation is going to have a more qualitative representation, because what this cares about is not so much where the lights come from, but the quality of the light. And by quality of the light, I mean the wavelength of the light. You get also another parameter, which is the vector of polarization of the light, which is used by many insects and many organisms, many high organisms, for finding their way around. Okay, so we need to focus on those photoreceptors and to see how you make those type of photoreceptors that you have in the retina. And again, if we have to achieve color vision, you need to compare the input between different types of photoreceptors. In the context of your own retina, you have three types of cone. You are trichromatic, you have the blue, green, and blue, and red cones. And each point in space is seen by at least three types of photoreceptor. The integration into the brain allows you to discriminate which type of visual of wavelengths you see. And a fly does it with only two photoreceptors, R7 and RF on top of each other, but they can do it in two different ways. They can look in in two different ways. Can do it by those expressed rhodopsin 5, which is a blue rhodopsin in the RX cell, and a UV rhodopsin in the R7 cell. So you compare between UV, in the spectrum UV and blue. We can do it with another type, those expressed rhodopsin 4 and rhodopsin 6. What I mean by that, here actually you compare between a UV and a green, sorry for the color, and here between a UV and a blue. So in one case you look at the cold color of the spectrum, the case you look more at the warm color of the spectrum. And what you have here is actually there is always a very tight coupling between the expression of this rhodopsin and that rhodopsin, this rhodopsin and that rhodopsin, those two cells. I mean, you never see this rhodopsin with that rhodopsin, you never see this one and that one. So at the end, what we have is a situation where you have two types of omatidia, those express rhodopsin 3 and rhodopsin 5, rhodopsin 4 or rhodopsin 6. Two types of omatidia and four cell choices which have to be made. And those choices are made first by a stochastic choice. I'm going to tell you later that it's being done in that the R7 cell. Then there is mutual exclusion between those two choices. But of course, because they always come together, if you have two stochastic choices, I need some synchronization, some coordination between the expression of the signal. So we need to see how we can try to understand this process at the molecular level by looking at different levels of regulation for the expression of those different signals. So you can imagine that if you have four choices to make here, you could imagine that maybe you're going to have some similar type of regulation for this one, this one, this one, and this one, and you get to modify one or two factors in which each one of those promoters in order to be able to achieve this type of regulation. And you'll see it's not at all what's going on. So I just want to go back to what we know about fly eye development and how those different types of cells are first recruited to become photoreceptor cells. And through the work of many people, in particular from Matthew Freeman, we know quite a lot about what happened very early at the level of the imaginal disk. So we heard a lot yesterday about the wing imaginal disk, where the grain of DPP was able to pattern this imaginal disk. The case of the eye imaginal disk, things are quite different, although they use the very same factor. They also use DPP, hedgehog, and wingless, and they use them in such a way that at some point you could look at the expression pattern of those genes, and they would look very similar between the fly eye or the fly wing. Okay? However, the rules are quite different, and the interpretation of the signal are quite different. But what happened is that always these gradients lead to the formation in a very regular way of cells which get defined as being founder cells for each one of the omatidia. And this founder cell is called the R8 cell, one of the cells I mentioned to you earlier. So what you have, you, through this morphogenetic gradients, what you do, you position very precisely R8 cells at different locations in the disk, and those cells are going to then do the job of finishing the eye by recruiting the different type of photoreceptor. And they do this by using the same signaling pathway, the EGF pathway, by recruiting 2,5, 3,4, 1,6, and then through the R8, sending a special signal to R7, the BOS7 signal that I'm sure you have heard about. And this happens very quickly, within the next few hours after the R8 cell is recruited, and it's done in a sequential way. Yesterday we talked about gradient, we never took into consideration time. Here, time is another component, another dimension that allows a very precise recruitment of those cells. So, after the R8 cell is recruited, and we can... Yes?
But also the connections to the brain are
formed, so,
they are specified.
Absolutely. So, immediately after those cells are made, immediately they are recruited as neurons, and immediately they send projections. And R7, R8, which are the first one and last one cell, first and last cell to be recruited, are going to immediately project to the medulla, and R1 to R6 are going to project to the lamina. That doesn't mean they make connection, but they project there and they wait. They know exactly where to go, and actually the lamina doesn't even exist, because actually those projections are inducing the development of the lamina. So they stand there, projection, and they wait there, and they will connect much few days later.
They don't need
Absolutely not. No. This is totally hardwired. There is no input from the activity of those cells. Actually, at this stage, those are not at all photoreceptors. They are just neurons. And actually, if you look later, 4 or 5 days later, when the eye really becomes an eye, what you have is that you have erased a lot of this information which was here. Again, through the specific utilization of the EGF pathway, each one of those cells has a different combination of transcription factor, which define mostly the identity of those cells. But if you look into the adult, actually much of this information is erased. In a sense, as I mentioned it to you earlier, R1 to R6 are all doing the same thing, the outer photoreceptor cells. And R7, R8, again, which was the first and last cell to be recruited, perform very similar role. And if anything, R7 is on top of it. Okay? So, at this stage, these are photoreceptors, and it's actually neurons. So at least there is something quite important we have to realize here, is that those cells here have a dual function. They serve as photodetector, but they also serve as neurons, which is quite different to what you have in your own retina. In your retina, you have the photoreceptor, that are not really nerve cells, in the sense they don't even depolarize and never send action potential. And then you have the ganglion cell, which are going to integrate the information from the photoreceptor and send the projection to the brain. So in vertebrate retina, the function of those two, the neurons and the photoreceptor, has been split into two cell types. Here, just one cell type. So the question that we have is that how do we achieve that, and how do we go from taking on this information, precise combination of transcription factor, which is expressed at this time, and we achieve this differentiation? And the second question is that why do we lose information I told you each one of those cells is specified differently. Why do we lose information when everybody here actually is going to be absolutely similar in terms of its function? The quick answer to that, actually, the only thing that matters here, this combination of transcription factor, is likely to provide the position of those cells within the omatidium. They function physiologically the same role, however, they know exactly where they are. You remember they form this trapeze, and this information is only required for telling them where they are in the trapeze, which is going to be very important as to where they're going to project into the brain. They are not important for the function of those cells. Yes?
When you say recruited, what do you mean? That they actually move and come?
Okay, so what happened again? This is from Matthews. R8 cell is first born and then just going to talk to his neighbor, his immediate neighbor, which have no lineage relationship, and recruit them. Say, okay, I send you a signal, now you're going to become 2-5. And then together, 2-5, and I get to send another the same signal actually, and recruit 3 and 4, then 1 and 6, and then the R7 cell. So just basically they recruit the neighbor. Recruiting them, they just induce them, and those are going to activate set of transcription factor.
And it's most probably not present here, also the champion occupied. I mean, there are many eggs happening in the same place, right? At some spacing.
Yes.
And how does the gradient do that, or is there some kind of rate at which?
So it's, again, it's happened sequentially. What you saw at the level of one single boundary between the hedge, where you have the expression of DPP in the imaginal wing of the fly. This happened repetitively throughout the disk in the sense that the stripe instead of remaining stable just moves. And every time it moves, it just recruits one row. So you have rows which are recruited after rows. And the next row is also using a pre-pattern from the previous row. But I don't think it's what we need. It's not what I want to address here. It's a very interesting problem. Okay, actually, I want to tell you that, in fact, those cells, not only they have erased some information, that is, they have erased more information than we have. Actually, they all want to become outer photoreceptor cells. How do we know that? We know that actually because of some experiments that we have done, and basically of a gene that we have identified, which is a transcription factor called SPALT. We heard about SPALT yesterday as a target of the DPP pathway, but now it's a different life of SPALT, okay? Totally different life. And what SPALT does, it's a gene actually that is required for distinguishing between the outer and the inner photoreceptor cells. How do we know that? Because SPALT actually is required for making R7RA. In the absence of SPALT, the trapezoid that you saw before, again, with R7 cell in the middle, is disrupted. And in the SPALT mutant, instead of seeing 7 of these, what we call rhabdomine, which has the rhodopsin-bearing light-gathering structure of the photoreceptors, instead you see 7, H1 is below. In the SPALT mutant, everybody becomes an outer photoreceptor cell, and you all have this shape.
And therefore don't express rhodopsin.
So, what happened is that as a consequence of that, they are actually seem to be transformed morphologically into outer. Actually, they also change the type of rhodopsin they express. Now they're going to express all the outer photoreceptor rhodopsin, which is rhodopsin 1. Okay, so it seems that you have a transformation. But what's surprising?
Open yes. Transcription factor.
Eh? SPALT, the transcription factor. Yes. Actually, we got to look at SPALT for a very simple reason. We're just trying to analyze what the process was doing, and we are just using a large-scale, what we call enhancer trap screen. Basically, we look for genes which were expressed in interesting pattern in the late photoreceptor in the adult. And we find these genes were specifically expressed in the R7 and R8 layer and nowhere else in the adult. This gene was actually a SPALT gene, and it is the staining for the SPALT gene. And of course, SPALT has many other lives throughout the life of the fly, including, again, the imaginal disk. But here, it was another specific life. It must likely be controlled, actually, we have identified the element controlled by a specific promoter element that controls expression in R7R8. And just because of this expression pattern and because it's a transcription factor, we thought it might be interesting to look at this function and how we realized that actually SPALT was indeed the gene that was required for taking this ground state where everybody wants to become outer and transforms it into inner photoreceptor cell. And again, in this case, it doesn't distinguish between R7R8. Something which is interesting, actually. And actually, in a SPALT mutant, you do not change the pattern of projection to the brain. That means those cells, also, they totally change the morphology and the type of expression of rhodopsin in the head. They still know who they were, because they know where to project. They only change the late differentiation program, and they kept the initial differentiation program. So specification was fine, but differentiation was wrong. So actually, you can see that even for a given cell, you can have several steps in the process of differentiation, which can be distinguished genetically. Actually, not only SPALT is required for making the R7R8 cell, but it's necessary, it's sufficient. If you force expression of SPALT in those outer photoreceptor cells, everybody becomes inner photoreceptor cells. It means express the inner photoreceptor rhodopsin, get the shape, and also, but maintain still the normal set of projection. So you only affect late process, not the early specification process. So again, this is interesting also because you can see that cells which were specified very differently early. Again, R8 is the founder cell, R7 is the last, the junior, which was recruited last by a specific pattern, and they seem to be put in the same pot here. They just express the same SPALT, and they become inner photoreceptor cell. Yes?
Are 1 through 6 distinguishable in the pattern of connections?
Yes, but the projection is a very complex pattern that we can talk about it if you want, but they absolutely need to know who they are.
So that's where the difference in the initial specification.
Yeah. So they actually need to know who they are in the trapezoid in order to be able to predict properly here. But again, this is a totally different story. So what we have at this stage, we took some information, we erased all of this information, and actually what we want everybody to become outer, and then SPALT make sure that those two cells are going to be inner photoreceptor cells. But then you need to distinguish further because you need to reconstruct. There is a much more diversity which exists in the context of this eye. So actually, we need to distinguish between R7R8. And we did identify the gene that is responsible for that, which is a gene called Prospero. And Prospero, as you will see, is a transcription factor of the homodomain family, which actually is expressed in the nucleus of the R7 cell and allows R7 to be distinguished from the R8 cell. Okay, so stepwise, you start, everybody the same, makes inner, then distinguish R7 from R8. How do we get to this Prospero? So at this stage, we have to look at the end product of the differentiation, which are the rhodopsin genes themselves. And as Eric pointed out this morning, these are actually not transcription factors. These are not regulatory genes. These are the end product. And as such, and consistent with what Eric said, those are very simple promoter in the sense they are not modular promoter. They are just very 200 base pair next to the tata box, and then you can reproduce the whole pattern of expression. This doesn't mean that the expression, the transcription factors that bind are going to be simple, but at least you have only one module which is required for expression. So the first thing that we did actually, again, we used a phylogenetic approach in the sense that we had a promoter from at least three species for each one of those. Okay? So we have very lot of information in terms of the conservation of those sites, and what we can see is that we can define actually elements which are conserved in all of those species. And first thing which jumps to our eyes here is also those photoreceptors, all expressing photoreceptors, they share very little in common. You can see very little color code in these cells which are going to be similar. The only thing which is common to all those photoreceptor genes actually is this box here, which is very close to the promoter. And we have shown that this box is a bounding site for a transcription factor called PAX6. And as you might know, PAX6 is called the master control gene for eye development, in the sense that if you don't have PAX6, you don't form an eye. If you express PAX6 ectopically in a wing, for example, you transform the wing into an eye. Okay? And the same in vertebrate. So it's a gene that is on top of the hierarchy of the formation of the eye. And people were very surprised when Gehring came out with this result, because the eyes are supposed to have been invented many times throughout evolution, and the fly eye, as you could see, has not much in common with the vertebrate eye. And so the interpretation of that was actually that maybe PAX6 is such a conserved gene in terms of its function on top of a hierarchy, because its initial ancestral function was to control the end product of what is the basic of an eye, which is the base of an eye, which is to become a photoreceptor to express rhodopsin. And indeed, you find this PAX6 binding site in all of the rhodopsin promoter, and presumably they provide some photoreceptor identity. But this photoreceptor identity is not sufficient. At least one copy of this binding site does not provide any expression. If you oligomerize this binding site three times, you get expression in every photoreceptor. But in the context of those real rhodopsin promoter, one copy just provides a sub-threshold information. As you said, you should be expressed in photoreceptor. And then those upstream boxes are going to tell them you need to be expressed in one or the other subset of photoreceptor. Now, again, looking closer, what you can find here that surprisingly there is little in common between genes like RH3 and RH4. Also, those two genes can be expressed in R7 cell, and basically any R7 cell can express this one or that one. So how come they share nothing almost in their promoter while they express in the same cell? Same thing in RH5 and RH6, you find very little in common. So presumably this means that the strategy for using, for expressing rhodopsin 3 or rhodopsin 5 4 must be different, and you get to see why. There is something we find in the promoter of rhodopsin 5 and rhodopsin 6. By looking closely, we actually did find an element that was common to this rhodopsin 5 and rhodopsin 6. So it's basically an element which is common to both R8 rhodopsin. So of course, when you find this element, you say, let's try to mutate it. So we mutate this element and look at what was the expression of the gene. Oops. So what you have, this is a cross-section to an eye, and you can see the expression reproduced by a very short 200 base pair element of the rhodopsin 6 promoter, and you can see it expressed in a subset of the RH cell, which are in the bottom of the retina. These cells here presumably express rhodopsin 5. Now, if you mutate those binding sites, in rhodopsin 5 or rhodopsin 6, what you get, misexpression in the R7 cell. That means this gene, which is absolutely specific to the R8 cell, now if you just kill one binding site, it gets derepressed in the R7 cell. Again, which emphasizes the fact that both R7 and R8 have a lot in common, because it's just by repression that you kill the rhodopsin 6 into the R7 cell layer. So of course we thought that this must be a repressor in R7 that prevents R8 rhodopsin to being expressed in R7 cell. So we tried to find which gene was binding there. So we run one hybrid, which is this technique in yeast where you take the binding site, put them in yeast, and try to find through a library of cDNA which factor from flies bind there. We came up with one gene. The gene is Prospero, which I mentioned earlier. And things became very clear when we saw where Prospero was expressed, because Prospero was expressed exactly where you expect it, in the R7 cell. It's a perfect location for being able to repress the R8 rhodopsin into the R7 cell, which is what the binding site appear to do. Again, Prospero is a homodimer transcription factor which has many roles in development. It's just one specific role late in development which you can analyze. So, of course, because this gene has many roles, it's a Lister gene, you cannot get a fly with an eye to do that. So there are very simple techniques in flies which can just make mutation only in the eye, and the rest of the animal is perfectly wild type. So we can use these techniques and look at what happened in a Prospero mutant. And what you can see in a Prospero mutant, you have two genes, an R7 rhodopsin and R8 rhodopsin, okay? And here just the other R8 rhodopsin. In a Prospero mutant, you can see that the RH5 is now misexpressed in the R7 layer, and RH6 is also misexpressed in the R7 layer here. So again, Prospero mimics the deletion of the bicoid bindings. I was switching to the other talk. it mimics the deletion of the binding site we find in the promoter, and presumably Prospero is a gene that does this, that function in doing that. So what we have now at this point, that again from the ground state, Spalt makes inner photoreceptor cells, and then Prospero is going to do two things. It's going to make sure that R8 rhodopsin are not expressed in R7, and make sure also that rhodopsin gene are expressed in the R7 cell. In fact, we do believe that the R7 cell express their proper rhodopsin, because actually they exclude this R8 rhodopsin, which means that actually if you misexpress the R8 rhodopsin into the R7 cell, this is sufficient for turning off the R7 rhodopsin, which means that actually, again, you have this exclusion mechanism I mentioned several times, where you cannot have two rhodopsin at the same time. If you fail to repress the R8 rhodopsin in R7, the R7 rhodopsin will say, okay, I give up, I leave your MySpace. Which again indicates there is some form of a ground state which is to become R8. And what Prospero does, it extinguishes ground state to allow the R7 state to be expressed.
Wait a minute, you're just
misexpressing
the rhodopsin? And that shuts off?
Yes. So, just to tell you the experiment, we have a 30-piece experiment on the Prospero chromosome. There was actually a rhodopsin 6 mutation. I mean, the rhodopsin was also mutant. And when we misexpress, so basically in this case, what you get, you misexpress a gene, but not the protein, because the protein is dead. In this case, there's no problem, the R7 protein remain in place. But if you put back the wild type protein, now you extinguish this. And again, there are precedents about that. Again, in the context of olfactory system, we know that the misexpression of, we know that the presence of an olfactory receptor in a cell is sufficient for conferring some cell fate to the cell. We usually knew. They must signal somehow, but we don't know exactly how. Something we're quite interested in. But again, we're not finished at this stage, because we met R7RA. But there are several types of R7RA. You remember, there are those expressed in rhodopsin 3 and rhodopsin 5, and there are those expressed rhodopsin 4 and rhodopsin 6. So we need to further build up on our system and try to refine and to distinguish with those two types of cells. Well, we have also identified the gene that is responsible for this class, and actually it's an old friend, because actually some genes that Eric just mentioned earlier. So again, going back to our promoter, we have this element that is common to the R8 rhodopsin, which we can call, if you wish, an horizontal element. What about a vertical element, something that would be common to one subtype of Omatidia? And actually we did find one of these elements, which is actually an element found in a promoter of rhodopsin 3 and rhodopsin 5. You remember, those are two genes which are not expressed in the same cell, but they're always expressed in the same material, and they're always coupled. These are what you call K50 binding site. They're actually binding site for a specific class of homodimeric protein, which contains lysine at position 50, and Bicon is one of those, but OTD, OTX, which Eric mentioned, is one of those proteins that should be able to bind to this, and you will see actually it is OTD that bind to those sites. So we got quite excited, and we said, maybe this actually is the element, these are the elements that control the vertical discrimination between one class of Omatidia and the other class of Omatidia. So of course, we mutated those sites, okay, and exactly as it fitting with this model, when you kill those sites, you lose expression of rhodopsin 3, which is expressed in a subset of R7 cell at the outside of the retina, and in the cell underneath, in the R8 cell that expresses rhodopsin 5. Both of them, if you kill the site, actually disappear. That means this binding site, K50 binding site, are required for the formation of one subset of Omatidia, but not of the other subset of Omatidia. So we got all excited. We say, okay, let's see what is a binding protein that is binding there. However, this was early in the game, and at this time, we just cloned rhodopsin 6. And the whole model collapsed, when actually we also found that rhodopsin 6, which is not expressed in the same as the others two, also contain K50 binding site. So it didn't make any sense anymore. So what we did, we just killed those binding sites, and we killed those binding sites instead of losing the expression of the rhodopsin, as we saw for the rhodopsin 3 or rhodopsin 5. We did the opposite. Now the very same binding site, exact same 6 base pair sequence, if you kill them, normally rhodopsin 6 is expressed in a subset of R8 cell. If you mutate one single binding site, you totally derepress rhodopsin 6 into the outer photoreceptor cells. And you can see that well, because it's a lactic transgene that goes down the axon, and you can see they have staining into the lamina, well, you never have staining in the lamina, because the R8 or the promoter, or the R8 cell don't protect the lamina, it only protects the medulla, which is here, okay? So basically, the same binding site seem to be able to do two opposite functions, to activate one subtype and to repress the other subtype. So we identified a gene that was binding there, and we had some bias about what to look for. This gene is OTD, whose other species called OTX. And what you can see in an OTD mutant, and again, it's a gene which has many functions, including a function in specifying the anterior posterior axis. Eric described it as one of the targets of the BCOA gene. OTD is a highly conserved gene found from hydra to human. But there is, actually, you can make specific mutation into the eye. In this case, we took advantage of a specific allele. And in the OTD mutant, you don't affect rhodopsin 1. You lose rhodopsin 3 and rhodopsin 5 the same way as you lost expression of the gene when you kill the binding site. And you expand dramatically the expression of rhodopsin 6 to the outer photoreceptor cell. Okay? So I'm going to try to go back to this in a model at the end to try to explain how we believe this works. So this is what we propose. So in one subset of Omatidia, you have OTD. OTD is exposed to turn on rhodopsin 3 and rhodopsin 5. I told you, in the absence of rhodopsin of OTD, you don't get rhodopsin 3 and rhodopsin 5. But OTD is expressed everywhere in the retina, in all photoreceptors, which means that it's going to be expressing rhodopsin 3 and rhodopsin 5 in both R7 and in RA. However, in R7 cell, you have Prospero, and Prospero extinguishes rhodopsin 5. So in the R7 cell, no problem, protein 3 will be the only gene to be expressed. In the R8 cell, OTD turns on protein 3 and protein 5. But protein 5 is dominant over protein 3. And the fact that you have protein 5 will turn off protein 3 in this cell. And again, we don't know how it is achieved. We don't know how it's being done constitutionally.
It's being done at the transcription level.
We know it's done at transcription level. So if you have a protein 3 like the construct, you do repress it. Okay? In the outer photoreceptor cells, where OTD is also expressed, OTD has a totally different role. It's actually involved in repressing protein 6 in those cells, most likely along with a co-repressor. And there is evidence that next to the OTD, the P50 binding site in the protein 6 promoter, there is another element that presumably mediates the binding of a co-repressor. And finally, in the other category of Homatidia, what you have, OTD again is not acting on those promoters because they don't, there is no activating site on those protein 4 or protein 6 promoter. And what you have is that, again, I'm going to come back to that now, but you have Prospero making sure protein 6 is not expressed here, which allows protein 4 to be turned on in this cell. And here, protein 4 is not activated because only protein 6 is activated through a process that remains to be identified. So what I mean here is that something is able to turn on protein 4 here, and these things can be excluded when protein 6 gets turned on when there is no Prospero, but we need to find the element that binds this here.
But these cells have OTD.
All those cells have OTD. But here OTD is not acting because there is no target on which to act. Okay? So what I mean also is that the fact that protein 3 and 5 are expressed in this cell and not in that one is not due to OTD alone. Okay. They need a cofactor along with OTD to turn them on in this cell. And I might come back to that later. So again, going back to my scheme, inner Prospero makes R7, and then OTD makes RH2 and RH5. What about this gene here? How do we express protein 4, protein 6? What we know is that there is one gene called spineless, which is a gamma transcription factor, which appears to be specifically expressed in this cell to be able to make this subset. Again, the gene I just mentioned in the previous slide model, to tell you that we need to turn on protein 4 specifically in this cell. So I don't want to tell you how we got to spineless, because, again, a bit serendipitously, but we know that in a wild type, we have a mutual exclusion between the R7 protein into the R7 layer, and same thing in the R8 layer, protein 5, protein 6, okay, so it's a wild type. In a spineless mutant, everybody expresses protein 3, you no longer express protein 4, and in the R8 layer, it's also almost true, but you will see why it's almost true, why not totally true. In the sense that now you have, although you have no protein 4 here, you have a few cells that still express protein 6. You will see why. And if you force expression of spineless in all cells, what you get now, everybody expresses protein 4. Actually, what I mean everybody is really everybody, including the outer photoreceptor, the inner photoreceptor, everybody expresses protein 4. So it's a gene which is necessary and sufficient for turning on protein 4. So most likely it must be fairly high up in the hierarchy. We express it right after the cell has been recruited for becoming neurons, and then they start to becoming photoreceptor, express a gene called GLAS, and there is a GLAS promoter which can use to drive expression. Actually, we can even use a late driver, which is protein 1, and we can transform the outer photoreceptor into RH4 expressing cells, even if it's very late in development at the time when the protein gets turned on. So again, this is going back to our scheme, and it seems that we have achieved what we wanted to do, in the sense that we can see you can turn all expression of those different genes, and we have all of the partners which are required here, except the cofactor that helps OTD specify the cell, those two class of cells compared to those type of cells. There is still something missing. I mentioned very early in the talk, there is another category of Homatidia, which I call the dorsal rim array. It's just one that was in the first image on the side where everybody was expressing protein 3. That is a special class of photoreceptor where everybody expressed protein 3 in the R7 cell, but also in the R8 layer underneath. And this is bizarre, because if you want to achieve color vision, I told you, you need to compare the input between two different cells that have different wavelengths. But this actually absorbs the same wavelength because it's the same rhodopsin. So what could be the purpose of those? You can get some clues actually by the fact that actually those rhabdomeres are a bit bigger. And also they are very regular in terms of the array of membrane that bears the rhodopsin. Well, this actually is a polarizing filter. The way those structures that bear the rhodopsin are made is that the cell body sends those long projections with a lot of membrane. And R7 does it that way, R8 does it that way, orthogonal. So what you have is a perfect polarizing filter. And those membranes are basically wall-to-wall rhodopsin arranged in a very regular array. So it's a beautiful polarizing filter. And basically you can see, you don't compare the wavelength absorption between those two photoreceptors, you compare the vector of vibration of the light, which is the nature of the polarized light. Why would the fly care about that? Simply because...
Yes, I can scream louder now. Okay, so flies are small and they need to have some landmark to find their way around, and the best landmark they use is the sun. However, sun is not always there. Sometimes there are clouds, and when there is cloud, they can use the reflected light on the sky, which is always polarized light. And by knowing the exact vector of polarization of the light, they know exactly where the sun is. Okay, so basically every animal does do it. I mean, we don't do it, but... and actually, we got to look at that because, again, through the enhancer trap screen, looking at gene expression, interesting pattern in the eye, we found a gene that was expressed specifically in the R7 and R8 nuclei of just this row of Ommatidia that contains this very weird configuration. This gene, again, was a gene which is very well known, called homothorax, and maybe Richard Mann will tell us more about it. And homothorax is a very pleiotropic gene that makes many functions during development, a very important gene. Here, it's very specifically expressed in these two cells at the dorsal margin, but only in those cells that are going to become the inner photoreceptor cells. Okay? So what you can see here, again, this is the equator, which is a midpoint of the eye, and you can see it's expressed in two cells, starting actually one row short from the equator, only the dorsal part, but basically the part of the eye that faces the sky. The co-staining with Spalt, and you can see that there is total co-expression between Spalt and this gene homothorax. And again, homothorax is going to be turned on in those cells that are going to become inner photoreceptor cells. So you need to become inner, then you can become dorsal rim area photoreceptor cell. And again, it's expressed in both R7 and R8 cells. So it seems that what happened, you have a black and white ground state from which you spalt to make the UV color vision system, and then you're going to use homothorax to specialize into the navigation system of the dorsal rim area. Typically, again, this is a view of the dorsal part. You don't see any morphological feature here. However, the photoreceptors are much bigger here in the center, again, because you want to have this very regular array of membranes. In the rest of the eye, the photoreceptors are much smaller. They care more about the quality of the wavelengths and not so much about the polarization. Now, if you kill the homothorax, make mutation in the homothorax gene, you lose the dorsal margin, and if you force homothorax, they need to force dorsal margin formation everywhere throughout the eye. Everybody will become sort of rather small, big photoreceptor, and then need to express rhodopsin 3 in both R7 and R8. But only in the inner photoreceptor cell. Even though you put homothorax throughout, those outer photoreceptors will not get transformed into dorsal margin, which means they need to know that they are inner in order to become dorsal margin, dorsal rim area photoreceptor cells. So, again now, we had at first this stochastic distribution of the rhodopsin 3, rhodopsin 5, rhodopsin 4, rhodopsin 6, and then you have right at one location very specific expression of another subclass which is specified as the polarized light detector here. So they express at the dorsal rim area, so they need some dorsal and some rim influence. Okay, makes sense. And they also need to be in the inner photoreceptor cell because, again, the outer don't get to become dorsal rim area. So they need to know that they are inner photoreceptor cell because they express Spalt. Trivial, easy. They develop at the rim because actually they're going to receive a signal which is a wingless signal. Wingless is expressed just outside of the eye, and it's going to send a signal which is going to receive by those cells that express Spalt and transform those cells into expressing homothorax and becoming dorsal rim. However, only the dorsal part of the eye does that, not the ventral part. And actually, what this is due to is the fact that the eye knows what is dorsal versus what is ventral because it expresses a series of genes called the ROC gene, which are again homeobox genes, which are expressed in the dorsal half of the eye. And the combination of all of those genes is sufficient for turning on this gene in those things. Again, to illustrate that, what you can see, This is actually the expression of the ROC gene that marks the dorsal part of the eye, not the ventral part. So here you have a retina, a view of the retina, and you can see homothorax is expressed in the dorsal half at the rim, but not in the ventral half. If you force expression of some of this aroquat gene throughout the eye, what you do, you're going to extend the dorsal margin throughout the, oops, can you move the projector? So you can see the dorsal margin extends throughout the eye all around, okay? So that means that now you fail to repress because actually you manage to turn on expression of homothorax throughout the eye because everybody becomes dorsal identity. Yes? Yes, the major difference actually that at the equator, I don't know if it's visible on this slide. You can see at the equator, this is dorsal, this is ventral. You can see the equator, there is a mirror image. You can see here the staining of these two markers, okay, is actually opposite side. And that is very important because the way the fly eye develops, there is a wave of differentiation, everybody becomes a symmetric chromatidium, and then on the either side of the equator, you're going to have rotation as compared to this midline point, and then the cell are going to be able to acquire different position. This is actually a good example of postulating planar polarity. The purpose of that, this rotation, is actually to making a region at the center with some form of a fovea of the fly. It's a region where the fly sees better because through the complex set of configuration, there is more projection reaching the same cartridge in the brain. So this actually it's the region of high sensitivity of the eye.
When the wave propagates the initial rocket, which way does it go?
So it goes that way. I mean, that way. So it goes along the equator. Okay, so if you force expression, you make everybody dorsal, the dorsal rim goes around. If you force expression of the Wnt pathway, so what you do here, you do armadillo, which is one of the readout of the Wnt pathway. You force expression of Wnt, you have to do it, take it easy because the eye doesn't like the Wnt. But what you can see here now, you transform the whole dorsal area into a dorsal rim area, but only again the inner photoreceptor cells. And again, the specification in terms of dorsal ventral remains here because this is actually the domain where the ROC genes are not expressed. So you can see you have this combination of influence coming from dorsal and rim, and all this can be perfectly integrated to giving rise to this information only in the inner photoreceptor cells. Okay, so what we have here is, again, the pathways that I just described to you. And just before finishing, I want just to describe the last thing, which is how do you manage to, once you have this information for making those different type of photoreceptor, how do you make sure that you synchronize those expression between those two types of cells? I told you always find rhodopsin 4 and rhodopsin 6, and you have exclusion between those two. And again, if you have a stochastic choice made, the stochastic choice can be made only in one cell, not in the other, otherwise there will not be synchronization. The question is that who makes the choice? Is it the R7 cell or is it the R8 cell? It's something we can test very easily in flies because we have mutants. So what we can do is kill, for example, the R7 cell. If you kill the R7 cell, now everybody becomes rhodopsin 6. You lose the rhodopsin 5. What this tells you that in the absence of an R7 cell, there is only a ground state in the R8, which is everybody wants to become RH6 expressing R8 cell. And upon expression of the rhodopsin 3 above, this cell will change its fate and express rhodopsin 5. Okay, so the model is like that. This is a cell that makes a choice. It normally is expressed rhodopsin 4. By default, this one expresses rhodopsin 6. If this one switches fate, expresses rhodopsin 3, it's going to exclude rhodopsin 4 and force, through a signal that remain to be identified, expression of rhodopsin 5. Okay, so it's a form of an acquired state for R8. Yeah, but again, R8 formed first, but this is 4 days earlier. This is a process that very likely occurs much later at the time of differentiation of the photoreceptor. Okay, so again, my point is that we erase much of the information that Matthew has done. And you start from scratch, remembering actually, because I'm sure this information is remembered to know which one is R7, R8. But again, this information is no longer used for the differentiation. So it's a different process. And again, R8, which is a noble one, the big one, lose it out to R7, which is the last one to be recruited.
Can you do the opposite experiment
It's a bit harder because if you kill R8, there is no eight-less mutation because if you have R8, you don't have an nomatidium. So there are ways to do it. And Steve Witt has done that by genetic complex genetic mean. He deletes his cell, and those cells appear to make a right choice. They make the stochastic choice. Both choices are being made independently. We could also do is make situation within one nomatidium we have more than one R7 cell. And in this case, there is a stochastic distribution. Those cells make independent choices. Yes?
What is the relative numbers of the 3-5?
So it's always 30%, 70%. And it's a ratio which is highly conserved throughout evolution. In Musca, which is 100 million years away from flies, still 30, 70. I don't really understand what this is. It's totally stochastic. We try to do near-neighbor. We don't find any pattern. I was told that maybe 30-70 is good if you want to have to make sure that rhodopsin 3 are always in contact with rhodopsin 4 cell. And I don't exactly know. Again, there is a big problem here because, you know, you imagine that if you have this type of things that look into the short wavelength, into the long wavelength, why would you need to have this system? Because don't forget, those two omatidia point in different directions in space. That means they don't see the same point in space. So what's the point of having two ways of detecting things if you cannot integrate it? So very likely, you need to integrate this with motion detection. You need to know that you don't, instead of looking at the two points at the same time, you just look at them sequentially. So you need to know who your neighbor is. So maybe the 30-70 ratio is for this purpose, to make sure that after rhodopsin 3, you have rhodopsin 4.
But the neural connections are already set up, and the flight path between 3, 5, 7, 4.
Okay, I said that the projection were going down. I didn't say about the connection. So connections are only going to be established later in development, and is what the next step, what we're trying to figure out now, is what the target neuron. Is it like in the olfactory system where, for example, all those neurons that express rhodopsin 3 are going to converge to one point in the brain? It's the kind of question we're addressing right now. But again, projection is not the same as connection.
So have people gone through a bunch of eyes and seen that, you know, there's a spread around 30-70?
Yeah, absolutely. So it goes from 15 some eyes to 20 in some other eyes. And again, it's a bit hard to, we're trying to devise system for testing that in terms of the behavior of the fly. And the problem is that, you know, for testing color discrimination, you need a behavior assay. So, you need to teach the fly how to recognize a color, and then try to train them, and then you can try to tell them. And it's not so trivial. They don't like to learn colors. They like to learn odors. They don't like to learn colors. I don't know why. Yes? We try to do near neighbor and really, stochastic is always full of pattern, but if they're not reproducible, I don't think, so really, we can't find anything there. No, but again, we did near neighbor, and especially with 70-30, actually the ratio, the one picture I showed you, the ratio was a bit biased. These are not easy, technically are not easy to get, so you know, to show beautiful picture, I had to choose one where the ratio was not fine, but trust me, there is no pattern we can detect. So the question is that there must be some communication whereby rhodopsin 3 expressing R7 cell communicate with RH5. Okay? So how can we get this? And again, in flies we can do this type of experiment because what we can do is just find mutation where this, for example, will be normal, but the communication will not proceed. And this cell will behave like if there was nothing above, and it will develop as a ground state expressing rhodopsin 6. We did find some of those mutations. One example here is a mutant where almost everybody expresses rhodopsin 6. It's called DON, for the Daltonian in French for colorblind. And we wanted to know whether this will be on the sending side of the signal or in the receiving side of the signal. It could be that this one failed on the signal or this one failed to receive it. You can tell those things in flight simply by making this cell mutant or that cell mutant. And it's beautifully illustrated in the next one. You can see those green here, those two cells, which are R7 cells, are green, because those are unique cell, unique clone of one cell, which actually are mutant for the DON gene. And you can see, in spite of being mutant, they still express rhodopsin 5, which means they are fine, which most likely indicate that the gene is required on the receiving side of the signal and not on the sending side of the signal. Okay. Now, we have to find the other types of phenotype where everything is normal into the R7 cell layer, but actually, now everybody gets to express rhodopsin 5. So it seems that everybody believes it received the signal, although the signal is not sent from the RH4 cell. One of these genes is called LATS, and the other one is called MELTED. Interestingly, there are two genes which have been picked up by several people, including from Steve Cohen's lab, for being involved in cell growth, both genes. And in those mutations, what happens is that everybody seems to express the red gene here, which is rhodopsin 5, and they don't express the ground state rhodopsin 6. And if you force expression of LATS, for example, now everybody express the rhodopsin 6 gene, which means they all express the ground state. So in the absence of LATS or melted, nobody expressed rhodopsin 6. If you force expression, everybody express this rhodopsin 6. And actually, interestingly enough, LATS, which is a kinase actually, is co-expressed with rhodopsin 6, exactly where it's required for its function. So in finishing, I just want to provide you with a model of how we believe things work. So in the absence, in the default state, what you have is that actually you have, default state, what you have is that melted and LATS appear to be genes that are required for, through a pathway we have started to elucidate, to repress OTD and repress rhodopsin 5 from being, prevent rhodopsin 5 from being expressed here. By default, rhodopsin 6 is going to be expressed. If the cell here has a rhodopsin 3 expressing R7 cell above, it's going to use the signal through DON, it's going to repress melted and LATS, it's going to allow OTD to be to activate rhodopsin 5 and therefore turn off rhodopsin 6. So you can see again, we don't know what DON is, we have not cloned it. Melted is a pH plexinomology domain, and we don't know exactly where it's expressed. We have some nice tools about it, but again, mostly from Steve Cohen's lab, and we're going to look into that. Again, both interestingly, both LATS and melted seem to be involved in some form of growth control. So, it's a plexin pH domain, plexin homology domain. So, and DLAT is a serine kinase. Was picked up by Chan Shu and in Steve's lab also. So, just in concluding, what you have is that presumably you had some form of initial set of omatidia where you compare the wavelengths. In order to expand the spectrum of detection, you at least split these two into two stochastic sets, one that look in a short wavelength, once you look in the long wavelengths, and then you adjusted something to expressing this the same rhodopsin in order to be able to discriminate polarized light. And again, this is very widespread. Every insect look at polarized light. Only one that I know which doesn't express is the German cockroach. He lives in your dwellings and doesn't need to have the polarized light. Some animals actually have a very broad detection of wavelength. Here it's only a very specialized region. And then there is another thing which is actually not in fruit fly but in Musca, the fly that Eric mentioned yesterday. And it's a weird thing where actually R7 now expresses rhodopsin 1. It looks like an outer photoreceptor. It actually also protects the lamina part of the optic lobe. It totally transforms into an outer photoreceptor, which means that now R8 has nothing to compare with. So it's actually on a process of degeneration and it disappears. So why would the fly happen to have 7 outer photoreceptors rather than 6 and lose color vision? Actually, it's not the fly. It's only the male and only one subset of the male eye. Only the anterodorsal part of the male eye which has this. So of course, if it's a male, it must be something to do with sex. And indeed, it is. Because actually what this part of the eye sees when it flies, actually the male sees the female through the anterodorsal part of its eye. And actually, it detects the female because it always flies from down below and from the back. So presumably, in order to see the female better, with 7 photoreceptors rather than 6 photoreceptors, it has completely lost color vision in one side of its retina. So I like to see how Eric's eye is defined. So again, you see that, again, you change one subregion, you provide some regionalization of the eye by changing the type of regulation. And again, there is enough plasticity to evolve from here to here, from here to here, and maybe from here to here. Okay? So to give credit to the people who did the work, so we call it a love spot, not the sex spot. So Matthias Werner has done much of the work on homothorax and on the last thing, that communication LATS and melted. Frank has done all this beautiful image, and Tiffany has done the work on the Prospero, where Bertrand, who used to be in the lab, has done the work on SPALT. Thank you. Yes. Yes. Okay, so yeah, good eye. So my interpretation is that follow. Okay, remember, in order to have rhodopsin 5 to be expressed here, you need to have a cell above it express rhodopsin 3. So the situation starts like that. You express rhodopsin 5 here, but then you extinguish rhodopsin 3, which means you fail to send a signal anymore. It's an interpretation which we are trying to unfortunately, we don't have rhodopsin 5 mutant, so it's a bit harder to test. But we have rhodopsin 6 mutant, we have rhodopsin 1 mutant, but we don't have rhodopsin 5 mutant. So it will be something interesting. But you have a very good observation, yes.
But it still doesn't appear to me that it's stochastic. Spineless
is so powerful that I believe it must be happening at this level. In the sense, if you have spineless, you express rhodopsin 4. If you don't have spineless, you don't express rhodopsin 4.
So
spineless
is expressed only in the subset.
So we have weak data to say it's expressed only in the R7 cell of which expresses rhodopsin 4. It cannot be expressed in it couldn't be expressed anywhere because it will turn on rhodopsin 4. But again, by being expressed in R7 cell, it's sufficient for allowing the R8 cell to be to turn on rhodopsin 6. So we believe that spineless must be the factor that that acts there. Spineless, it's a pass BHLH protein transcription factor again, which normally works in combination with another transcription factor, but in this case seems to work alone. So, and one of the features of spineless, actually, when you have a mutation in spineless, you have this, it's called also aristapedia. And you have a leg going out of the antenna. Actually, at the tip of the antenna. It's not antennapedia, it's aristapedia. Only the tip of the antenna becomes a leg.
But that's where you think the regulation happens, Mr.
Kastik? We believe it's at the level, so it must be at the transcription level of spineless, and we have no idea how this is being done. I mean, stochasticity is not something very easy. Yeah. Most likely, a combination of transcription factor gets to turn it on, and it must be right at the threshold. If it's at the threshold, if it goes over, it will express it or not, it will not express it. So. Yes?
If I question with 30-70%
to cross all. So 30-70% discrimination. How do you get this distribution? Yeah.
One question. When you say there is no pattern, do you mean that there is no repeatable pattern between different flights, or do you mean that there is no potential deviation from your Poisson distribution in each single flight?
So again, if we do near neighbor in 800 omatidia in the eye, we don't find any. So.
I'm fuzzy about this, but I think as the Merkin genetic wave passes through, about that, as it goes through, RA takes its dive in. Right?
Yes.
Now, does that movement have anything to do with these crossing inductions? So, would the process you described work if a Merkin genetic wave finished?
Is the fural aspect of a morphogenetics. The morphogenesis has to happen. The fural, I'm not sure. I don't know exactly. We have to change to use mutation which affect the dipping of the nuclei in the epithelium. And I don't. We have not done that. We have not thought about doing this kind of thing actually. Why would you think that this would be important?
I don't. Because you have signals between R7 and R8, and their geometry could that, and the timing of when they die that one part dies.
Maybe to corroborate, what's something interesting is that the R8 cell in the cell body has the nucleus at in the basal part, when the R7 has the apical part. In a Prospero mutant, the nucleus moves basal also. So we observe it, we don't know what it means. Eric?
Is the Spalt enhancer in the wing disk that takes the BDB and put the same as the Spalt enhancer in the eye disk?
No, I think it's a different enhancer. So Bertrand has dissected the enhancer and he found an element that control expression R7, R8. So.
If I remember it right, you have some overlapping binding site for some of the promoters of the rhodopsins.
Okay, so very interesting point. Actually, it seems that the Prospero can only act if it's next to an OTD binding, so OTX binding site. So you have the activator site and the repressor site, and they can only work if they're next to each other. They don't overlap, they're next to each other. So if you take Prospero binding site, so OTD, for example, you find in the rhodopsin 3 promoter, okay, but there is no Prospero binding in the OTD promoter, in the rhodopsin 3 promoter. So it's expressed in the R7 cell. If you put Prospero binding site in the context of the rhodopsin 3 promoter, randomly, nothing happened. If you put them next to the OTD binding site, it's going to shut off OTD and rhodopsin 3. Okay, and if you put, of course, you can make control if you put a mutated. So it's not this place which is important. It's really the location next to the OTD binding site which is important. And actually, we can reproduce this type of regulation in cell culture with OTD and Prospero. I mean, OTG will boost up expression and Prosper will repress expression, but they need to be next to the OTG binding site. And again, I don't know what it means. So there are, I mean, there are two homodomain proteins, but Prosper is a very divergent type of homodomain protein. And so, again, interaction among transcription factor is important. I mean, Eric Singh pointed out the geometry of those is important, but we don't really understand it. Yes? So RH2 is just another rhodopsin, which is related to rhodopsin 1, which is expressed in the ocelli. Ocelli has three small eyes, but made of 80 photoreceptors, which are on the top of the eye. Three, bizarre number. And actually what they do, when the fly flies, it's actually those three photoreceptors see the horizon. And the wiring diagram of this of the connectivity is perfect for actually looking at high contrast. So basically it allows to discriminate between the horizon, the bright sky and the ground. And actually this same type of wiring has been used by people to doing in remote airplanes. They have this kind of ocelli that allows the airplane to fly like that, straight and not like that.
Do you know if this amazing story is goes across many phyla, would it be true for horseshoe crabs?
In terms of what distribution? Okay, so it's again one of the best systems where color vision has been studied is in bees. And bees actually have a very different system in the sense that the bees have, instead of having rhabdomeres which are distinct, they're all fused together into one big fiber optic. So this has a big advantage, it allows to have a big surface of reception. However, there's two major disadvantages. First, that optically, the size of the acceptance angle is very big, that means the pixel is going to be gigantic. And second, also, there is a lot of filtering. That means that if you have different rhodopsins, those different fiber optics, they're going to filter each other because the photon is going to bounce back and forth in the fiber optic, which leads to a lot of trouble, which means actually bees have not been able to evolve a broad spectrum rhodopsin. Because there is one broad spectrum rhodopsin, they will filter out everything for the color vision. So the reason why flies have invented rhodopsin 1, which is a very weird molecule, it's only found in flies. It's a rhodopsin which has a chromophore in the middle and another chromophore outside to extend the spectrum of absorption. So the reason why flies have been able to invent this, because they split the rhabdomeres, they distinguish between the inner color vision system from the outer visual system. And so I think flies, for some reason, and I don't see obviously why from a biology would need to look at a lot of colors, but seem to have, they have devised a system which is very highly sophisticated for color vision. And the fact that they have these two types of rhodopsin is important. If you look in mosquito, for which we have a genome, okay, mosquito, again, they are very, very far. They are diptera also, but they are very far diptera. They are almost as distinct as the bees. They have six rhodopsin 6-like molecules. They don't have any rhodopsin 1 molecule, and they have one blue, one green, one UV. And six, one blue, one, they have six green, they have one blue and one UV. So they don't have the same level of sophistication. In the genome of Pseudobscura, which is another fly, which is also fairly divergent, 50 million years, we find the exact same configuration as in Menrogaster. So it seemed to be something very specific to the higher diptera. And again, in large part due to this open configuration of the rhodopsin. I must say that although it's something that seems to be a very big advantage to split the rhabdom, it has a major consequence. Like now, the rhabdomi are no longer at the center of the lens. That means actually all six or seven rhabdomere point in different directions in space. So they're very cross-eyed fly. So if you want to integrate the information, you need to be able to reconstruct that, and actually the fly does very well by reconstructing this into the lamina. And the reason actually with this very precise positioning of R1 to R6, they need to know exactly where they are, because they need to find which other rhabdomere in another omatidium look in the same direction, they'll be able to project together in the same place in the brain. We call this neural superposition, one of the most amazing system of exactly finding your way around. But it's only because of this neural superposition that the fly has managed to split the rhabdom.
And all the ancient
compound eyes have? No, I mean, it's only they're only specific to the higher diptera. So it's a very amazing system, actually.
I think we're going to thank you.
You think or you are?
I want to thank you.